you found the best place for quality internet talk. Around the clock and around the world. TalkZone.com. Now, more discussion of the issues facing you and your financial future. The Cyber Advisor, David Revelle.
Well, welcome back, everybody. I'm Dave Revelle, and you can reach us anytime if you'd like, toll-free at 888-463-6748. That's 888-GO-FOR-IT, or reach me on my email at dave@thecyberadvisor.com. Well, this week, the Wall Street Journal was noticing all the cash that's on the sidelines in the stock market. You may recall that one of the programs that the government instituted late last year was the insurance for the money market mutual funds. And for those of you who followed industry closely, you know that the cash has just been piling into those funds. Right now, there was an all-time high reached in January of $3.9 trillion in money market cash accounts. $3.9 trillion. Incidentally, that's a double from about 5 years ago. We hit $2 trillion in the money market funds only about 5 years ago. So we're almost at $4 trillion, almost double that today. And there's a theory that goes that if there's cash on the sidelines, that's a future demand for stocks and can be very positive for the stock market. The question, however, is not where the money may go. The theory may be correct that indeed the money will go into the stock market. The question is not where, but when. And there's been a big reluctance by any of these money market fund investors to return their funds back into the stock market. So we'll keep a sharp eye on this. We'll watch how the assets go. It is a great way to see future demand for stocks. $3.9 trillion in money market funds, an all-time record, nearly double what they had a few years ago. Well, one of the things we'd like to introduce this week is a new feature on the show, and that's email questions from investors like you. And we have our first one. Norm from Chester Springs writes, I wanted to get your take on the stock market. With the quarter that just finished yesterday, the market's up about 15%, which is the best quarter in over 11 years. And it's one of the third best quarters since 1939. This is on the back of 7 months of big gain. So what do you think it bodes for the market for the fourth quarter as well as into the first half of 2010? Well, one of the things that's most interesting about this type of stock analysis, and politicians and pundits alike like to kind of jump on the fact that the market, quote unquote, discounts the future. So it looks into the future of the economy and sees what's going to happen there. And it is true that the statistical relevance of the stock market is very important. But there are times in the market that they can overshoot the mark. And anyone who's looked at a graph of the stock market, be it the Dow Jones or any other indicator, sees that the market does not go in a straight line. It often goes very high or very low with valuations that can be on the high end of the scale or the low end of the scale. Good examples of those are the stock market from 65 to 66, or for 71, 72, or 86, 87. In all three of those cases, the market went through a great period of ebullience, thought that things looked great, and then faced in the year ahead big corrections on that. So the market is not infallible, but it is a pretty good indication. It actually, in those years, was not indicating the good times that that some people thought lied ahead. But as an investor, your job is not to get a portfolio too far out on a limb with an expectation that all of the good times can simply keep on rolling. One of the great analysis of this is a guy named Robert Prechter down in Georgia, who has a thing called socionomics, where he talks about how the stock market can almost become a self-fulfilling prophecy. What we do know about the market is this. As it rises, the odds of a consolidation get greater and greater. Right now, we place those odds of a consolidation or correction at least 60%. So the question is not for an investor or for anyone looking forward to the market. The question is not whether or not it will continue on. It's whether or not you should hedge against any future corrections or consolidations. But a great question, a question that we could probably go on for hours talking about, and a lot of people will debate just exactly what lies ahead in 2010. As we'll see later, the IMF makes a pretty interesting comment on this very topic, and we'll talk more to you, Norm, about how the IMF views the year ahead. Anytime you would like to reach me with a question, though, please feel free. It's dave@thecyberadvisor.com. Well, as you know, we are firmly convinced that credit is one of the most important attributes of any economic system. And incidentally, it is a question that is extremely relevant to how 2010 looks. And one of the bellwether economies out there, a new emerging economy, is Russia. And we're going to take an interview with Ruben Veradian, who is at Trioka Dialogue Group, that's the largest Russian investment bank, and ask him exactly how he thinks the Russian banks are coping with the current recession. Here's Veradian.
And the current crisis showed the weakness of the bank in Russia, with not enough capital, with big NPL, and it was clear signal, I think, from all private sector and the policymakers that the banking system needs to be changed. A lot of mergers. I would say the bank needs to become bigger. We saw some of the examples, like two Russian banks was merged, MDM and Ursa Bank. We also see the government bank become more capitalized, and they need to raise more capital to provide efficient services to their clients. Trocadalic, we've got the partner from Standard Bank, South Africa. They just bought 33% of Trocadalic. And I think it was a good other example of the other model where you're getting some international partners. We get some international bank entering in Russian market.
So what he was saying there might have been a little difficult to understand, was that he had a big investor in from a South African bank. So we see that there's a huge geopolitical dimension to all of the international economies out there. Russia, this Russian investment banker is looking to South Africa, and as he says in this cut, will also be looking to China for additional capital contributions. Here's Ruben Veradian again.
I believe we have a very unique model with Standard Bank. You know, it's the biggest shareholder of Standard Bank. It's ICBC, the biggest Chinese bank. And I think it's the list of the China-Africa-Russia relations. It's become very crucial and important. If M&A business will grow not only in the United States, but will grow in other part of the world. And with our network and knowledge and expertise, which we own, I think getting us in a very good position to gain a lot of market share. In emerging markets, the M&A business is starting to recover. It's not in the back from the before crisis result, but we see a lot of activities, and we hope we can see a lot of deals will be done in the near future.
Now, isn't that interesting? So here we have really two emerging economies, but also two political systems which really have not always been friendly to free enterprise, China and Russia, each cooperating to try and bring more financial stability into their markets. But lest we ever forget, Russia is primarily an oil-driven economy right now, and here's a last comment by Ruben Veradian making just that point.
I mean, the current level of the price, I think, allowed Russia to continue quite good money, but in a more realistic level. Is why if the commodity price will stay in the current level, Russia will do okay, because the price around $70 per barrel, it's perfectly allowing Russian companies make money and be efficient. At the same time, it's not creating artificial profit.
So the Russian companies will do okay as long as the price is around $70 a barrel. So the price of oil is always the underlying linchpin for the Russian economy, something we can't ever forget. One of the concerns, though, that we see growing in the international system comes from China. and it's the general leverage of their entire banking system. Here, David Marshall from Fitch Rating Service. Now, Fitch is the third. There's Standard & Poor's, Moody's, and then Fitch. Fitch is one of the largest in terms of rating fixed income securities and a good bank analyst. Here, David Marshall from Fitch talks about the general bank leverage position of banks in China. Here's David Marshall.
Well, as you know, the Chinese banks are in an interesting stage in their development. I mean, a few years ago, they were state-owned banks. They were commercialized. But now they occupy a sort of an intermediate position. You know, they're neither fully state-controlled, but neither entirely commercial. After all, if you think about it, if other prime ministers or heads of countries, the government in other countries asked their banks to lend aggressively to stimulate the economy, banks would probably say that's not really our role, you know, because of the risk of taking on a substantial amount of problem loans. In China, they've done that, and I think it highlights the fact that, you know, the government still controls these banks, so it can use them as instruments of economic control. But at the same time, they have been partially commercialized, so they do have credit officers trying to make decisions. So I guess the government thinks that at least, you know, channeling some of the stimulus to the Chinese economy through the banks, at least some of that money should be going into viable projects. But given that the banking system in China is already very large, bank credit to GDP is a very high number, the additional lending is huge. And so at a time when the economy is under some pressure, certainly corporate earnings are under some pressure, plus the fact that, you know, some of those loans are leaking out into the asset markets, into real estate markets. Yeah. There's certainly some corruption going on. You know, some politically directed lending, overtly politically directed lending, some of it, particularly at local level. I think, you know, we have some concerns that, you know, some of this lending is probably not going to be recoverable by the banks. And that's why we sort of have these medium-term concerns about, you know, sort of the level of credit quality, even though the NPLs currently look really low, precisely because the loan growth has been so strong, the ratio has come down.
What a really, really interesting picture, because here's a country struggling to get a free enterprise system, very different than ours. In our country, when President Obama proposes a stimulus package, basically the funds are directly invested by Treasury and others within the government in government-sponsored program. He talked a lot about building the infrastructure, building bridges, and all of that sort of thing in the country. In China, It is currently not operating that way, according to David Marshall. Not only, it's going beyond that into not only direct investments by the Chinese government, but also a stimulus by the government in direct funds to the banks, which they in turn are to lend out. So the banks, already heavily leveraged, are being asked to leverage up even more by the government. And this is starting to place them in a position that is very, very tenuous. We've said many times the problem with leverage is it looks great on the way up as you loan out more and more and more. However, the ability for people to repay is the critical part of any loan, and that becomes very iffy as this process kind of goes on. When he talks about leakage into the asset markets, like into the equity markets and into real estate and so on, what he's really talking about is people who have so many dollars to invest that they take those dollars and put them in the stock market and other places instead of perhaps the infrastructure or other type of investments that they were supposed to make originally. Well, here's David Marshall as he goes on and now speaks about the other side of this. The banks that are asked to loan more and more, do they have enough capital to make those loans? And here's David Marshall from Fitch.
We would say probably not. I mean, if you look at the really large banks, you know, most of the three of the big four banks at least, I mean, they've actually been keeping 9 or 10% tier one capital ratios, which are not bad, actually. But it's the medium tier lenders, actually, that have been growing very fast, and their capital ratios come down. Tier one ratios well below 8%, some of them below 6%. So these are quite weak capital numbers for banks in any country. And given, you know, the rapid growth and the risks in China, you know, we think they should be keeping much stronger capital ratios. And of course, they're trying to do that. We're seeing Chinese banks coming to the market.
Who would be at most risk from the downgrade?
Well, the banks that really needed to raise capital, I mean, otherwise ratings would have come under pressure, I mean, are in fact doing it. It's banks like China Merchants, also Shanghai Pudong, also banks like Shenzhen Development have got quite weak capital ratios. And as I said, they're raising capital, but in some cases, I think the Shanghai Pudong, for example, although the capital they raise will improve their capital ratio, it still won't make it very strong. And what tends to happen with the Chinese banks, their capital comes under pressure, they raise new equity, but then they grow very fast, so the ratio comes under pressure again. They never quite achieve that stable equilibrium where they can grow at a reasonably brisk pace, but at the same time be able to generate enough of capital internally, you know, from their profits to continue to finance that growth. They grow so fast that they have to keep coming back to the markets in order to, you know, maintain strong capital ratios.
So it's halfway between a demand economy and a regular free enterprise economy, with the government continuing to put pressure on the banks to grow. And when the banks do, their capital falling behind. Very interesting picture. There's just one more dimension that I thought was absolutely great. It's added by Ben Steffendorfer, who's of the Royal Bank of Scotland, and Ben is also an analyst of the Chinese markets. He takes a look at China and says there's one last reform that China must do. I think this sums it up beautifully. Here's Ben Steffendorfer.
No, China certainly looks more capitalist today than communist. I guess the last big reform that needs to take place is property rights. And for the most part, land is still collectively owned, or at least owned by the state. Until we see land owned by private individuals, then it certainly will at least be still a socialist state.
But Ben, that's sort of happening with farmers, has it not?
It is changing. Certainly some farmers do have rights to lease their land for a certain period, but in the urban areas, land is still leased from the government. It isn't privately owned like it is in the United Kingdom or the United States.
So can you imagine, here we have a system where we need to lend more and more money, everyone says, but it can't be on land. I suppose it can be on the buildings, but not on the land. What an interesting problem going forward for China. You know, property rights are the fundamental right here in the United States and Western countries against which any lending is made. It's always against the property, but not in China. Very interesting, I thought. I enjoyed that very much. Well, it's time to take a short break. Please stay tuned. We'll be right back. There's more right after this.